Hello and welcome to this week's program. I'm Paul Nelson. To some, the 1960s was the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, a time of spiritual seeking, investigation of Eastern religions, and the beginning of a great societal awakening. To others, the 60s was about sinful indulgence in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. A man who personified these stereotypical aspects of the 60s was born Michael Riggs in California, but is now known as Bhagavan Das. He left the California suburbs for India in the 1960s and was even initiated there by his guru.
I covered myself in ashes, which is a sign of renunciation, and he gave me the name Bhagavan Das, which means servant of God, and I took off wandering all over India. That's when I went to Tirupati, was from the Kumbh Mela at that time, and spent the next 6 years living in caves, living as a hermit, spending all my time meditating and chanting, determined to get enlightened.
While in India, he developed this philosophy about sex.
You can't dam the life force. You've got to let the life force flow. And trying to control sex is very, very difficult. You've got to find out that everything is sex, first of all, that all life is sex, that everything is sex, so that the sexual energy isn't just localized in a genital sexual intercourse way, that every encounter is this in and out pulsating yin and yang opposites, everything's opposites. So unifying and bringing the opposites together is the thing to do. And sex is not something that you can make holy or sacred, because it is totally sacred and holy. So if we open our eyes and we look twice, right, we're able to see how incredibly sacred and powerful it is, and then give it that respect and honor, and it will tell you what to do.
A full hour with Bhagavan Das as we talk about his spiritual memoir, It's Here Now, Are You? That's our feature today. I hope you enjoy the program. Thanks for tuning in.
This program with Bhagavan Das originally aired in November of 1997, and we'll start our interview in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Northwestern Exposure.
The 1960s was the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. We're getting ready for a full blast, just as we begin to find the balance after the extremes of the 1960s. That excess that accompanied the expanded consciousness of the 60s and the struggle to find a balance are personified by one of the gurus of that era a quarter of a century ago. That guru is Bhagavan Das, born as Michael Riggs in California, immortalized without his prior knowledge by the Ram Dass book Be Here Now, which has sold hundreds of thousands of copies. The spiritual memoir of Bhagavan Das has just been released, entitled It's Here Now, Are You? And Bhagavan Das is our guest today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Honored to have you here, as well as your wife, Uma. Before we get going into the questions, you've brought a lovely exotic instrument in with you. So can you tell us a little bit about that and grace us with some song and some music?
Yes, it's called an ektara, and it's made out of a gourd with a long bamboo staff covered with a goatskin like a banjo, with two strings that are both tuned together and used by mendicants and sadhus in India, wandering minstrels.
Yeah, and you're going to grace us with some songs to start the interview.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Dhamma. Jaya Ganesha, 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 Kali Ma. Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha,
Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Kali Ma.
Well, that was beautiful, delightful. What a great way to start the interview. Bhagavan Das and his wife, Uma. Can you translate that for us? Exactly what that means?
Jai is praise or hooray or salutations or praise, meaning Jai. Ganesha is the elephant-headed god who is the remover of obstacles, the lord of the beginnings. And symbolically, Ganesh is the ancient one of the earth. It is the earth god, the elephant. It's the elephant god. So it's acknowledging the earth and asking for that support.
Now, I realize that part of the title of your book is a takeoff on the Ram Dass book, but why don't you tell us exactly why you chose the mysterious title of your book?
Well, I chose it because it's here now, meaning the reality of non-dual wisdom, the enlightened state of awareness, it's always with us. It's always here. It isn't anywhere else, and we just have to show up for it. So it's here now.
Yeah. One might take this, look at the book as someone who's realizing the times that we live in, the time of tremendous change, the time that John O'Donohue, a former guest of the show, referred to as the time after the death of the old gods and before the birth of the new gods. Gene Houston says we are the people of the parenthesis and going through tremendous change. So one could interpret that from the title of the book as well.
Yes, I think a new God image is coming forth in our consciousness.
How do you describe that?
Well, I think that the old ways have all come apart as all the cultures have blended, and with the websites and the internet, and everyone's everywhere.
It's like the conversation I was having with my friend at breakfast today, going to Mexico to a Chinese restaurant and getting these weird hybrids. Food is one example of the mixing of the different cultures. Yeah. When you were 16, you describe in the book a situation where you came home drunk, but it wasn't home, it was to the wrong house, and you had an epiphany of sorts, if that's possible when you're drunk, that everything in your California suburb was exactly the same. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, you know, the whole idea of it was just the same house, the same cars, the same mom and dad, the same people, the same sisters, everyone had the same dog. It was really kind of scary to me. It just seemed like this mechanized... everyone was just moving on this conveyor belt, just like chickens going from the birth to the death without any awareness or consciousness of originality or uniqueness.
And that was when you realized you had to seek your path somewhere else, basically. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. And I went through the book, and I make little notes in the book, little things that might be interesting to ask. I made quite a few notes, as you can see there. So I'm just going to pick out some experiences and ask you to describe them. The first thing I'd like to get into is a sense of the difference between the cultures. And I guess the difference between American culture and Indian culture is exemplified by the intense energy at the temple at Tirupati. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, Tirupati.
And you compare that to the energy on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And to me, it was really exemplified by that. Why don't you describe your experience in the temple?
Well, it's just the most... Tirupati is the richest temple in India. I mean, it is just like billions of dollars go into this temple. And the image in the temple is probably 20 feet high, carved out of this solid black sologram stone, like a mountain, and it's just covered in gold and diamonds and rubies and emeralds. And the interior of the temple, there's hundreds of Brahmins chanting these intense, melodious Sanskrit chants. And there is just millions of people queued up like 24 hours a day going into the temple with offerings and the atmosphere of devotion. People have come from miles around. This is like their once-in-a-lifetime experience to come to the temple. And they all shave their hair, so everyone's bald. They all give their hair to the god. And they get blessed with whatever they want, basically, which is usually material things. Like they want a son, they want a better job, they want good grades in school. They're very practical.
Yeah. You wanted your hair.
Yes, I wanted to keep my hair.
Yeah.
I was there strictly for enlightenment and, the heartfelt devotion of it. So it's like that frenzy of the stock exchange, only everyone shouting mantras and holy names like, I love you, God. Thank you, God. Govinda, Govinda, Govinda. And just this massive devotional hysteria,
yeah,
which really gets you caught up.
Very intense prayer. And,
yes,
and yet when we look at what's happening on the New York Stock Exchange, that might be our culture's version of prayer in a way.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And we get that. They get the money quite often. They get what they are praying, mm-hmm, for quite often. And mm-hmm, yet there's not enough money that can fill up the hole that that's trying to fill. I guess we can get into that as we go along. Another example of the difference in cultures is that in India, if you meditate a lot, you say in the book, people will support you with food because they feel as if you're doing work that benefits society. A notion in this country that would seem ludicrous to a lot, mm-hmm, of people, but not in India. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the idea of having a whole culture of professional mystics or professional saints. And what they do is they maintain a life of poverty. So it'd be like the bums that we have here on the streets, but they would be respected and they would be kind of cleaned up bums. They wouldn't be all like drunk and down and out and, you know, messed up with people kicking at them and giving them dirty looks. They'd be respected. And therefore you'd find these sadhus or people that have like a really tight ship. They may have like one piece of cloth on that's ragged, but it's all clean and they're all tidied up and they're doing their practice and their hair's, you know, together, and you know what I'm saying? Their back is straight, they're doing their beads, and they're benefiting the society because they're putting out those vibrations.
Cleaning the psychic airwaves, I think
there,
is how you describe,
yes,
it. Which is something I can relate to.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about your initiation and the way you received your name, Bhagavan Das?
Well, I was initiated at the Kumbh Mela, which is a fair that's held every 12 years when Jupiter goes into a certain constellation and the nectar pours out of the sky, astrologically speaking. And at this fair usually draws about 30 million people or plus.
And amazing things happen, like people, elderly people throwing themselves in front of wagons coming by to,
yes,
die in that particular ritual.
Exactly. There's so much devotion going on. I mean, you have, imagine 20, 30 million people all praying, chanting, going crazy for like 3 or 4 months in one spot with just intense devotion. There's millions of naked sadhus with hair down to their feet. It's absolutely the most amazing spectacle of devotion that you've ever seen. And, you know, all of these people are bathing in the river, and the river for miles is simply covered in flowers. There's just hundreds of thousands of flowers. You wade through the flowers to get into the river. So in this atmosphere, 1966, my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, also known as Maharaji, initiated me, and I covered myself in ashes, which is a sign of renunciation, and he gave me the name Bhagavan Das, which means servant of God, and I took off wandering all over India. That's when I went to Tirupati, was from the Kumbh Mela at that time, and spent the next 6 years living in caves, living as a hermit, spending all my time meditating and chanting, determined to get enlightened. In this lifetime now.
Be careful what you wish for, right?
Right.
We're talking with Bhagavan Das. He has his spiritual memoir out called It's Here Now, Are You? I'm Paul Nelson. Was it at that, now I'm getting confused about the book. I've only read through it once, but was it at that particular ritual where the Divine Mother came to you as this incredible
yes.
beam of light? Right.
Right. I had an experience. So the day after I was initiated by Maharaji and given the name and became a sadhu or a professional mystic, I came to the tent of the most famous woman saint in India named Anandamayi Maa. And she has been in a God-intoxicated state or like a trance state her whole life, ever since she was born. And she stopped feeding herself when she was about 18 or 20 years old, somewhere in that. And so she's constantly just fed and taken care of and had no desires for her body, what her body did. So she was in a very incredibly high state of consciousness. And I walked up to give her a rose up to her tent. And I stood outside the tent quite a distance from her, and her whole body looked like this light was just like a white cloud of light. And I was just standing there like looking at her in awe and devotion. And the next thing I knew, she started coming towards me. She got up off of where she was sitting and walked through the crowd. And there's probably 20, 30,000 people in the tent. And I was just so blown away just by the vibe of standing there, seeing her in the distance. You know, I couldn't do anything at that moment. And she floated towards me like this cloud of light, came up to me. I gave her the flower, the rose. She held her hand out. And then I went down and touched my forehead to her feet and went down into the center of the earth. The earth opened up, and I went into it, and I've been worshiping the Divine Mother ever since. It's been my form. In other words, I got the initiation, and then I got the form. So it was like Mom and Dad.
Of all the people who she could have gone to at that particular event, she came to you. Why do you think that was?
Well,
is it important to ask why?
I don't know. You know, I mean, maybe this tall Westerner with blonde hair, but I think maybe it was just the destiny of touching me and giving me that blessing and experience so that I could be sitting here now and write this book and that I could be of some help to my people.
And putting some water on the source of the fire.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I opened the interview with a description of the Aquarian Age. That's a simple one for people. But you say that in the book that we're living in the Kali Age. Why don't you tell us about Kali and the age that she exemplifies?
Kali, the Kali Yuga, or the age of Kali, is the age of blackness and destruction where everything is crazy and young kids kill each other and everything's topsy-turvy and the only thing that confers rank or status is money. And, you know, so on and so on, right?
Sounds accurate so far.
Yeah, exactly. You know, widespread pollution and people are just greedy and selfish and do not really have spiritual values. And women are mistreated very badly. And this is called the Kali Yuga. It's the age of dissolving. So Kali, the way it's looked at in India, it's like the bull of Dharma has four legs. And in the first age, Satya Yuga, he stands on four legs. And then he loses a leg. In Treta Yuga, the Silver Age, he stands on three legs. And then Dwarpa Yuga, the Bronze Age, he stands on two legs. This is the legs of Dharma or integrity of, you know, spiritual principle. And Kali Yuga, he stands on one leg. So he's crippled. But as things get darker and darker, there's more and more light here. Because the kids look around and they know what's real. And we start to not fall for it anymore because we have to come back inside. So in a sense, it's really the best age because everything's gone. You can't just, you know, depend upon anything.
Certainly the things that we've depended upon in the past, the old systems, and we see the entropy, the late mm-hmm. states of entropy that our system's in, mm-hmm. government, economy, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, and go on down the line. The Hopi have a proverb a prophecy, perhaps, and I'm going to paraphrase it, which is horrible, and I apologize for that. But in this time that we're living in, the time of the cleansing, the time of enlightenment, there will be people so captivated by their own fear, they will literally drop dead. So we see that in this time we have an opportunity for enlightenment, living through this age, or dying and coming back, and perhaps being better able to deal with this kind of an age. You see that as accurate?
Yes. I mean, my understanding, what I've seen with the Hopi prophecy, according to the Hopis, has been fulfilled. The age of destruction has happened. And they made four times to come to the United Nations to bring the message of stop it, right? And no one listened. So it's taking place. We're heading, we're all heading off the cliff. But they say there is a red road. There is a road out, but it's straight up. And they draw the line, like we're going from here to here on a vertical, and then there's this straight up road. So it's like straight up to God. It's like straight up, let's go. So someone who really wants to do a spiritual practice now and really get on it, you can get more merit and more advancement in 3 days than you could, say, in 30 years, right, a long time ago, or in another age, like in the 1800s or, in ancient times. In other words, it's so bad, it's so dark. No one's calling God up on the phone, right? Everyone's busy with the world. So God's, you can get through.
Operators are standing by.
Operators are standing by to take your call. And you will be able to really get incredible. Ramakrishna said, in the age of Kali Yuga, if you could pray and cry out to God for 3 days, that you would have enlightenment. I mean, nothing else to do. You lock the door in your room, you unplug everything, you sit down, and you just go for it. I love you, God. I love you, God. Help me, I can't do it. You throw yourself on the mercy of the divine. I mean, but, few do it. But there's the potential.
And there's the big if.
Yes.
We're running out of time for segment number one. We asked you to be here for an hour, so we still have some time. Can you hang around?
Sure.
Great. We're talking with Bhagavan Das, the author of It's Here Now, Are You? And what I'd like to do, we have about two or three minutes left in the interview. What I'd like to do is close the segment with more music. Great. And
we'll sing to Kali Ma, the goddess of who takes away the darkness, the goddess of Kali Yuga, the Black Mother.
Jai Ma Durga Ma Ma Kali Ma Jai Ma Durga Ma Ma Kali Ma Jai Ma 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 Kali Ma Jai Ma free. Jai Ma. Ma